from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is Tales from the South.
An hour must have passed before Dad walked in on my cousin and I. Even at the age of 7, I could recognize the smell of whiskey on his breath and how to measure the lowness of his eyelids in relation to how he was going to act.
Recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas.
Delighted, we spotted the cat trotting toward us, but then she let out a wail of pain and longing that forever rings in my ears as the ultimate agony.
Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story, as if they were sitting on the porch with you.
And without a moment of regret, I decided that I hated it. And if the ocean was anything like this stupid bed, then I hated it too.
So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
There's cold times have severed. Take a look and know, just tell me that you love me. Every now and then, just tell care every now and then. Ooh.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? They have CDs for sale after the show, and you can hear more at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen in her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? This week, our stories are all about turning points. As our writers move from innocence to knowledge, their lives forever changed. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Karen Lee's childhood naivete is washed away in rushing water. And we'll end the night with Courtney Fraser Jones as her eyes are opened to a world she had not known before. But let's start the night with Sarah Clark as her childhood simplicity is taken away with one swift motion in No Man's Land.
It happened the summer my cousin Kira came to town from Cumming, Georgia. I was 7 years old, Kira 6. As usual, my mom went to work on the night shift at Arkansas Children's Hospital, leaving my dad in charge of our dinner, baths, and a reasonable bedtime. She kissed us goodbye right after dinner, and we knew the next time we'd see her was right after breakfast. All responsibilities for my brother's, Kira's, and my well-being were left with my father. My parents moved to America from Ireland in the late 80s, before I was born. My mother was a nurse of 15 years, and my father an aspiring artist, who later received the prestigious Donahue Scholarship from the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. I grew up in the popularly laid-back neighborhood of Hillcrest, where almost every street is named after a tree, mine being North Palm. There were 5 other children around my age that lived on North Palm, all of them boys, including my older brother, David. It's no secret that my father had a drinking problem for the majority of my brothers in my childhood. We theorize it started long before that, but was never noticed, or perhaps it was chosen not to be. What I remember most is Sunday afternoons while Mom was in bed, when David, Daddy, and I would go on surprises. We'd climb into our 1991 blue Ford Windstar van and end up in a field full of hay bales where Dad would photograph us. One photograph in particular ended up being a drawing of the two of us, a Christmas present to my mother. Or we'd go to Barnes & Noble so my dad could read while we went to the children's section and lazily, uninterestedly, read books far under our reading levels. Us kids were surprisingly limitless for our ages. Mom would be baking an apple pie or her famous among friends, Irish brown bread. Apple pies on good days, brown bread when she was missing home. And right before I slipped out the screen door, my bare feet, prematurely calloused due to rough hop pavement and ruthless pebbles, she would call to me, "Stay with your brother." The simplicity of the rules we were to abide by gave us an unspoken and never questioned okay to play hide and seek in underground tunnels that trailed through every alley, or see whose team would dominate the other and capture the flag, or the sidewalk in front of Max's house was a safe haven, also known as no man's land. I distinctively remember sitting on Adam's couch in his living room after having found a photography book illustrating a nudist camp. I didn't know what to call the heat that enveloped my face as we leafed through and saw bare nipple after bare nipple, or the tuft of a grown man's pubic hair. Us kids were invincible. From the moment we crawled out of our bunk beds until the sun went down and our mothers stood on, out on the porches, calling us in for dinner, or din-dins, as my father would say. We even felt invincible after our plates were successfully licked clean without any spilled milk or a dropped fork. When it was bath time and we thought if we'd hide behind a door long enough or if we ducked in the covers and didn't move, it growing more difficult to breathe in each passing moment, Dad would give up, stop running the water, and let the grime build up in the creases of our arms and the sweat between our toes crest over. Inevitably, there came a time when the popsicles we took turns licking, between runs to the sprinkler, melted, the red dye crying down our forearms, our lips cannibalistically stained as if we were just at war. In a way we were, but it was with ourselves. Each new shoe size was only a reminder that Legos and Barbies and making mud pies were noticeably less fun than the last time. Our imaginations were seeping out of every orifice. Even the excitement of reading seemed to have diminished. Mommy's voice got a little more stern, as did Daddy's once gentle, inviting hands. And so on this particular night, while Mom was at work, it was Daddy who made sure me and my cousin Kira got in bed. After the two of us were tucked in, it was as if my dad didn't exist. In our giggly world, it was just the two of us. We snuck into the bathroom at the end of the hallway, toting with us my collection of nail polish. An hour must have passed before Dad walked in on my cousin and I, bare naked, nail polish staining the floor. Even at the age of 7, I could recognize the smell of whiskey on his breath and how to measure the lowness of his eyelids in relation to how he was going to act. In the midst of my first surprised inhale of breath, my dad already had me off the floor with just one hand tightly gripping my upper arm. Immediately following that, I felt the sting of his hand ricocheting off of my bottom and tops of my legs, over and over and over. David was standing groggily in the hallway with apologizing eyes. At 10, there wasn't much defending he could do, and I understand he hated that. The next morning, I told my mother, "Daddy hit me." She pulled up my nightdress and stared at the backs of my legs for what seemed like eternity. There was that unfamiliar heat of embarrassment on my face again. Without a word, she left the room, coming back with her Magnavox film camera, and she took photos of the bruises, just in case, she told me. My father never hit me again after that summer night in 2002. My parents divorced shortly afterward, and for the most part, I've lost all contact with him, excluding the occasional email or sticky note on the front door reading, "Hey, it's Dad. I thought I'd stop by. XOXO." My last vivid memory of being a child is my father's cherry red face and his hand pelting my backside as if it was the only chance he'd ever get to do so. The strength in his slaps beat the innocence and naivety out of my being. In the few moments I was dangled by one arm in my yellow bathroom, I lamented every mud pie I'd ever made. I said goodbye to my Barbie friends and I lost interest in getting dirty with the boys. My father turned the knob on that bathroom door, it opened, and the future rushed in.
Sarah Clark is a senior at Little Rock Central High School. She is a page editor for The Tiger, the school's newspaper, and also takes a senior creative writing class. In our next story, Karen Lee takes us back to her childhood and a breach that changed everything in Flood of Memories.
The rain started early that morning. I was 11 years old, and I woke to the sound of thunder rumbling, the drumming of raindrops on the roof. When evening fell, with not much let up of the downpour, the radio announcer was warning of flash floods and heavy rains expected overnight. My mother's face was set in worry as she stood sentinel over the radio. My father, who was a minister, manned the phone, performing his shepherd's duty as he checked with the various church members, assuring the safety of his flock. My sisters and I felt a vague discomfort enveloping us, even as our parents reassured us of our safety. We fell asleep to the endless patter of the rain, accompanied by the radio broadcaster's ever more ominous warnings. We had recently relocated to this small mountain town in western Arkansas. My father was a Baptist minister, employed by small churches, which were usually lorded over, not by the Lord himself, but by a clique of deacons and church ladies who claimed direct knowledge of the Almighty's wishes. My father, who himself thought he had the better connection to his maker, frequently butted heads with these contentious leaders, and so frequently found himself seeking the Lord's will as to a new church home for him and his family. When the Lord's will, not to mention the deacon's ill will, led to a move from the oil boom city in southern Arkansas, we had lived for 3 years, to this new home in the shade of a mountain, on a quiet road at the edge of a town of around 400 people. I was truly grateful for the mysterious ways in which the Lord worked. In my young eyes, we had moved to paradise. Relieved of the worries of traffic and other such city concerns, my parents allowed my two sisters and I a newfound freedom to roam and explore. We spent long mornings playing in the woods on the mountains and golden afternoons wading in the icy spring-fed water of the Caddo River, which was rarely more than knee-high as it raced over a rocky riverbed. My memories are of glimmering yellow butterflies hovering over my head as I splashed through the crystal clear water, bright sparkling in the sunshine, my sister's laughter as I chased them, ah, such a world of joy. Our world was blessed. We were special, protected by a loving God and devoted parents. Evil and pain were contained in hell and not possible in our own little heaven on earth. And then came the rain. Around 4 a.m., we were awakened by knocking on our door. As my sisters and I peered around the corner of our bedroom door, we saw our parents ushering in one of the older ladies who was a member of our church. Miss Annie lived by herself with her little dog, a mama cat, and her 5 kittens who had just been born a week before in an old trash barrel. Her house was about 2 blocks from the river, and she described how she had been awakened by her dog barking. And when she swung her feet off the bed, they landed in water. She picked up the dog, then splashed through the water, walking until she reached our house. We listened in amazement at her tale and watched in fascination as our mother plied her with towels to dry her dripping hair and soak clothing. My dad headed out after enlisting the aid of one of the church deacons to see who else might need rescuing. I had a difficult time envisioning the shallow, sparkling stream that I played in as a raging, deep, and dark river that had surpassed its bounds and engulfed the town where many of my friends and neighbors were. And suddenly, fear of what might have happened to them, fear of the unknown, intruded into my usually carefree thoughts. We kids huddled together on the sofa, a new awareness of the darkness around us. Not the comforting, safe darkness that we had spent our nights in heretofore, but a scary, unfamiliar darkness filled with unknown terrors. Miss Annie was worried about her cat and kittens, and she was also very worried about her neighbors and their new baby down the road. My mother had us all join hands and pray. After our heartfelt prayers, we felt comforted, us girls assuring Miss Annie and each other that, of course, things would be all right. We were special to God, after all. Our dad was the leader of his church, and we had absolute trust in both the Lord and our Father's abilities to protect those in their care. As morning dawned, the rain ended, and we ventured out to see what the light of day revealed. Almost as fast as the river had risen, it seemed, the water subsided, and we joined the stream of people trekking through the muddy streets, anxious to inspect the mischief wrought by the wrathful river during the night. Miss Annie gazed in despair at her once pristine dwelling, now coated in mud and debris. She and my mom started cleaning as we girls searched for the mama cat and her kittens. Delighted, we spotted the cat trotting toward us, but then we stopped in our tracks as she let out a wail of pain and longing that forever rings in my ears as the ultimate agony. "What's wrong with her?" we asked our mom. "She's calling for her kittens," my mom said. Miss Annie spotted the old trash barrel, so we went running to where it was, and we peered in at dark water. I reached in and, to my horror, pulled out a small, wet bundle of fur. I ran with it to my mother and pleaded with her to help it. She cried with us as she retrieved the 5 drowned kittens. The mother cat howled incessantly, and I could feel her agony. Suddenly, a new sound joined the cries of the cat, a sound that chilled my very soul, so fearsome that I swiftly closed and clenched my eyes, refusing to even acknowledge such horror. The world was no longer a carefree place of endless light. The darkness now loomed ever-present as a possibility. And the future I blithely skipped toward before suddenly looked foreboding. I ran blindly, sliding through the mud, away from the overwhelming pain in that sound, away from even the possibility of the existence of such an agonizing world. And in that moment, I ceased to look forward and started my longing for the past. My sisters told me later of watching Miss Annie's neighbor as he carried a small bundle toward town, and they described the screams of his wife as she cried and called for her baby. I do remember refusing to attend the drowned baby's funeral. I went for a walk instead, in the rain, my tears mixing with the raindrops, as I heard the mama cat yowling, still looking for her kittens. Years later, I sat in a dark room, staring out the window at the rain. I had refused to attend the funeral of my newborn son, who died shortly after birth. As I stared at the rain sliding down the glass, the hot, salty tears borne down my face and mixed with the warm milk flowing from my breasts. And as a howl of despair broke loose from my throat, I heard the sound of the mama cat's agony, calling over and over for her baby.
Karen Lee has learned to swim well through too many floods. She is currently engaged as a chauffeur, tutor, and research assistant during science fair projects for her youngest son, a junior in high school. In our final story of the night, Courtney Fraser Jones discovers there's much more to the adult world than she ever suspected in Trinity.
I wish I could remember how it happened, or the one thing Melanie and I said or did that swayed my parents' thinking to ours, but I can't. I doubt seriously it was the promise of a room kept neat forever, or the willingness to sign a contract drawn up by my lawyer father, our signatures hugging the line, from then on contractually obligated to absolutely never, ever ask for anything ever again as long as we both lived. Most likely the decision was one of surrender, rendered out of relentless, caustic begging, suffering parents worn clean through. Whatever it was, I was never the same again. Well, you know they have a waterbed, Edward informed us over a box of candy cigarettes. The year was 1982 and we all smoked. We bought our ciggies at the gas station down the road from our house, a summer tradition financed by my mother, a woman no doubt desperate from the blessing of so many children. The excursion cost her $1 a day per child, but was money well spent, delivering her one solitary hour each day. I always chose Kings, my older sister Melanie Target. Edward, our neighbor, bummed, his parents not allowing him to buy something so close to the truth. What's a waterbed? Someone asked. It's a bed made out of water, and when you sleep on it, you feel like you're floating on the ocean, another someone informed. The subject had come up during the debate over whether Melanie and I should be allowed to attend a sleepover at the home of the newest family in the neighborhood, an invitation shouted over the fence by the ringlet-haired 12-year-old of the family. We desperately wanted to go, but so far hadn't received a straight answer from our parents on attending. My mother participating in a superbly dissatisfying campaign of, we'll see, my father simply deferring. I'd never been to the ocean, only a lake, but even at the misinformed age of 10, I knew enough to know that the lake, which was awesome, paled in comparison to the ocean, which by all accounts was the most awesome. I was more determined than ever to get to spend the night on that bed. How do you know they have a waterbed? My sister asked. Oh, we saw them move it in. Then they took the hose inside and everything. That's how you fill one up. My uncle in Oklahoma has one. Edward lived at the end of our long driveway and so was an authority in all matters concerning front yards and people going up and down the road way too fast. Living so far back from the source of information rendered us handicapped as we only got the dull backyard happenings. Don't believe everything you hear, Melanie told me later as we mounted our bikes and took off down the highway. Nothing could be that good. Later at dinner, I put my parents through the ringer. Can we go? I asked. We'll see, spun my mother, the weaver of dreams almost but not quite fulfilled. I explained how they had a waterbed and it made waves that you could hear, just like when you put a shell to your ear, only louder, and seagulls too. I reported it all as fact without giving the slightest consideration that I was making part of my information up willy-nilly style, a skill I would struggle with my entire life. We'll see, my mother repeated. After dinner, I rode my bicycle up and down our driveway, checking out the front yard news. The new neighbors were out playing a game of softball around regulation bases. They were Kathy, the mother, Johnny, the father, Tanya, the daughter, Luke, the son, and Clive, the adult living friend. And my 10-year-old naivety, a mom, a dad, two children, and an adult live-in friend seemed perfectly reasonable. I watched them play, listened to the sound of the aluminum bat cross the ball, a sequencing sound shared between the ding and the whack. The adults ran the bases barefoot and in cutoffs, real cigarettes dangling from their mouths. This game, the sounds, these people filled up my night and my head, and I wanted more than anything to sleep on that bed. And then it happened. Tanya's mom had only one rule for the sleepover. We three girls could sleep on the waterbed, but we couldn't jump on it unless we wanted to drown. We did not, and so we agreed. I could barely wait for bedtime. I remember climbing onto the bed, my entire leg sinking in the corner between the frame and the bladder holding the water, my sister and my friend laughing hysterically as I gripped the sheets in my hands as if they were a rope and the only way up this Everest. I sank everywhere I put a foot or a hand, elbow or a knee, the bed swallowing me in gulps, waves spilling out beyond the stolen body part. Each attempt at ascent sent me tumbling further down into the bed and further away from my goal of reaching the others near the top. This Shangri-La of napping was the most complicated piece of furniture I had ever seen. And without a moment of regret, I decided that I hated it. And if the ocean was anything like this stupid bed, then I hated it too. Once the dumb thing finally spit me out, I spent the night on the floor. I later recounted the entire sleepover to my grandma. I told her about my anticipation for the waterbed, how I ended up hating it, how it had spit me out, just like Jonah and the whale. But she was confused about which family my sister and I had actually spent the night with. I confirmed it wasn't the nice Church of Christ family whose son bummed the candy cigarettes from me, but instead the family of five beside them, the wearers of cut-off shorts and liberated feet, the people whose lit cigarettes mapped a path as they ran around the regulation bases of their yard. And all three of you girls were going to sleep in the same bed? Wouldn't that have been crowded? I think it would have been okay, I answered. Mom and Dad say that Kathy, Johnny, and Clive sleep that way, and they're a lot bigger than us. All three of them. I overheard Mom call sleeping like that a trinity. Grandma never missed a beat. Come here. I want to tell you something. I moved closer, and in my ear, she told me the truth about that kind of trinity. I pulled back, my mouth gaping, but Grandma went on. Speaking of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, has your sister chosen Jesus Christ as her personal Lord and Savior yet? She had a knack for turning any conversation back to the Lord.
Courtney Fraser Jones is a writer and an artist. She is the creator of LuckySpouse.com, TheNewOldHouseProject.com, and is currently working on a novel, Pioneers of Big 80s Hair. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. Tonight's show is dedicated to my husband, Jason, with whom I've shared the last 23 years. We were married 13 years ago today. Happy anniversary. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website, more at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation in North Little Rock, Arkansas. Discover more at argentaartsdistrict.org. Our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle magazine at aymag.com. Additional support provided by the Winthrop Rockefeller Institute at livethelegacy.org. Also, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau and Oxford American Magazine, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing at oxfordamerican.com. Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.